put the responsibility for reducing, consume less, on the individual. And there's only so many of us that are going to do that, and so many of us that are going to sustain it. We need to combine that focus on personal change with a focus on changes in the system, and then we might actually see the potential fulfilled.
Welcome to Cambridge Forum. I'm Mary Stack. Today, we're delighted to have two well-informed experts, James McKinnon, best-selling Canadian author, and Vincent Stanley from Patagonia Clothing, to help us own up to our part in the global climate problem, namely our crazy consumption. The Day the World Stops Shopping is the title of James McKinnon's latest book, which imagines what would happen to our economies, our planet, and ourselves if we bought less stuff. He proposes that if we could reduce our consumption by just 5%, it would make a big difference, and we would barely notice the shift. Okay, well, this is a very good point, I think, to switch over to Vincent Stanley and include Vincent in the discussion. Vincent's had very long associations with a very innovative clothing company, which probably everybody knows, Patagonia. And they have embraced pretty radical practices for a retailer over the years, encouraging customers away from the throwaway idea and buy less but better. So Patagonia were always pretty pioneering as a company. You had a French, was he French or French Canadian founder?
A French Canadian from Maine, though. Yes.
Okay. And you and he wrote this book, The Responsible Company. So what is it that are the main, what are the main tenets of a business that is responsible? And is that concept growing fast enough?
So an organization like the Business Roundtable, which is made up of the largest publicly traded companies, 2 summers ago announced that they were disassociating themselves from the Milton Friedman thesis, which was very famous in 1970s, basically said the business of the only purpose of a business is to earn a return for its, the maximum return for its shareholders. And these companies, regardless of how they execute on this disassociation, have said, no, a business is responsible to its stakeholders. Stakeholders defined as employees, customers, communities you operate in, the environment itself, as well as the health of the business. If the business isn't healthy, you can't pay your bills and you can't do the rest of it. So the elements of responsibility that we talked about were precisely those elements of responsibility to the various stakeholders. How do you take care of your employees? How do you be a responsible citizen in a community? That's basically what the gist of the book was about. And then we presented, Yvon's a very practical man, so the last 60 pages of the book were checklists on what business people could do in order to change their practices to be more responsible. One last point, I'm reminded of this, that we chose that word very carefully. And there's a wonderful, from James's part of the world, Haida leader named Gerald Amos, who said that the most important right we have is the right to be responsible. And I think this applies to governments, individuals, and communities and NGOs, that sense of if you want to feel oppressed, put yourself in a position where you feel that you can't be responsible for your actions or for the actions you take on behalf of your family, et cetera. That sense of agency, that sense of connection to the world around you is really absolutely critical.
Here's Patagonia making pretty high-end products. No doubt about it. Not everyone can afford to go into Patagonia. But what are you offering, and why would I go into Patagonia instead of Primark?
Well, you might go into Primark or you might go into Uniqlo and see something that looks very much like a Patagonia jacket, but you really can't tell from looking at it on the shelf how long it's going to last, or what the social and environmental practices were that went into making that garment in the first place. Clothing is much cheaper than it was in 1970. Not only is it more prevalent, if you look at inflation, it's much cheaper than it was 50 years ago. And a lot of that low prices come on the back of the environment and consumers. So what you might do is say, okay, I'm not going to have two jackets this winter from Primark. I'm going to have one jacket. I won't say it's from Patagonia. We'll say it's from a small Swedish company or someone else. And I'll keep it longer. That's my investment for the winter. Or you might say, I want to take a holiday. I can't afford that new Patagonia jacket. I'll buy a used one that has a lot of life in it, but maybe it's 2 years old. Or if you're going skiing, and I'm not sure we have this in place yet, but if you know, a good ski jacket costs $700, rent one. You know, if
rent
you need
one.
Rent one. Mm. If you need one for a short period of time. This is part of what we need to do to change the conversation. It's not just, oh, I'm going to go out and buy a $19 t-shirt, wear it nine times and throw it in the dustbin. It's maybe I can't afford not to buy something that's better if I want to change the way my relationship to the things in my life and feel responsible to the betterment of the world.
I love that you mentioned that. I'd never heard of that before, borrowing it or renting it. Because somebody said to me yesterday when we were talking about this, they said, when was the last time you heard somebody say, I'm going to save up for that?
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't remember the last time I heard somebody say that. Which is very interesting. That whole concept of deferred gratification is completely gone. Yeah. So how do you envisage this? How would this play out if, say, we just all cut back in 5%? That's very modest.
Yeah, I mean, 5% would be a good start, I think. And if we think about that at an individual level, for a lot of people, 5% would be literally unnoticeable. I mean, people are buying twice as many clothes now as they did 20 years ago, they could cut the number of clothes down by 50%. And most people are not really going to be suffering. Most of the clothes we buy now don't make it through a year before they're disposed of. It would be pretty painless, I think, for most people to cut down their consumption, or many people certainly in a place like the United States, to cut their consumption by 5% or considerably more without having personal suffering of any real kind. The economy, however, would respond quite differently. And so that's where I think we need to look at what are the kinds of changes we can make in the system that allow us to move towards a lower consuming society and economy, but without it leading to disaster. And, you know, companies like Patagonia are, I think, providing some sense of what that might look like. You know, business models where there's less focus on growth, there's more attention paid to producing products that last and are durable and that create durable relationships with the products. Focusing less on the production of new things and more on the circulation of already existing things, maintenance and repair. You know, there are all these other sectors that we might be able to revive that will still provide economic energy, but will allow us to reduce our consumption. Ultimately, do I think that means that we would end up with a smaller, slower churning economy? I don't think anyone knows the answer to that question, but I think the answer is probably yes, that we ultimately have to right-size the economy to make it sustainable. But at the same time, I don't think that we have to go back to the Stone Age, right? I mean, we can create a much more sustainable economy without having to sink into the collapse of civilization, which I think a lot of people think is our only alternative.
Well, I'm going to say something here which might sound a bit kind of like reactionary, but the first thing you notice when you're a foreigner coming to the States, harkening back years ago when I came, is the excess factor. You see all the stuff that gets thrown away, even at a dinner table or in a restaurant. You see an inordinate number of TV sets, tons of cars parked outside people's houses. And then this Christmas tree factor that I notice, where entire houses are lit up and offices with nobody in them. You know, there was this bottomless pit of stuff, and it was all free. And you could just waste it. So I thought after the pandemic, you know, there might have been some sort of long lasting lessons from that. Were there any at all, or was it just this little blip?
I think early in the pandemic, something really important happened when people were locked out of consumer culture. I think within that window, a lot of people did have an opportunity to revisit their values and priorities, and even just to get a bit of a breather from 24/7 commercial culture. So I should say, I mean, it's not really surprising that ultimately we went back to consumption. I mean, most of us now have grown up since birth as consumers in a consumer society. There are all kinds of powerful forces that encourage us to consume. It's what we know, you know, it's how we form our identities. As I said earlier, we use it for so many things that I think it was very easy for people to go back to the comfortable embrace of consumerism. But what I'm hearing certainly is that a lot of people are doing that this time with mixed feelings and with some ambivalence about returning to full throttle consumption.
I hope you're right. You're listening to Cambridge Forum's discussion of The Day the World Stopped Shopping with Canadian author J.B. McKibben and Vincent Stanley from Patagonia. Anyway, we have got some questions coming in. I've got some more questions for you there, but about workers and actually workers' conditions, which I think is pretty important in this equation. For some people, shopping and visits to the mall are highly satisfying. Does being environmentally responsible have sufficient emotional pull to trump the urge to shop?
Yeah, there is lots of alternatives. I mean, I think even in the pandemic, we saw when people, certainly in my community in Vancouver, when people either were choosing not to go to stores or could not go to stores, culture pretty quickly reinvented itself around gathering in parks and eating and drinking. And in fact, it was illegal to do the drinking part, but culture accepted that in this circumstance. I mean, it's very clear that people were finding that deeply satisfying. As the pandemic went on, there was more and more of it. People just getting together and making conversation. I mean, there's also, for the sake of my book, I went to a borough outside of London called Barking and Dagenham, where they're playing out the world's largest experiment in participatory culture. And what they've done there is an organization has set up actual shop fronts on the streets of the borough. But if you go into these shops, there's nothing to buy, but they can connect you to literally dozens and dozens and dozens of free activities you can do, opportunities to learn, ways to connect with your community, ways to participate in your community and the creation of a sense of community there. And their goal is to make it so that any person in Barking and Dagenham can wake up and have all of these things available to them as alternatives. Well, I mean, certainly to many people, that would be at least as satisfying as shopping. And there's a critical difference, which is that with this participatory culture, it doesn't exclude people who can't afford to go shopping as a recreational activity. And so that's why Barking and Dagenham was selected, is because it's the poorest borough in the London area. And there were a lot of people there who, you know, they're not earning enough money to do consumer activities. And so they're doing a whole lot of nothing.
That's wonderful. Inspiring to hear that. Because before I go to you, Vincent, if you want to answer, on Sunday, I happened to be out going to a museum and I passed an enormous shopping mall and the parking lot was full. And I thought to myself, my God, imagine if, you know, everybody there was out planting a tree instead of shopping or doing something else. It's as if there's this kind of cathedral of consumerism now and people flock to it. It's like it's an addiction on the weekends. So I think this is tremendous, this idea of substituting through the shop urge, an alternative activity. I think that's amazing. It's a great idea. Vincent, did you have anything to add to that?
You know, there have been a few books about, two or three books about how environmentally devastated areas, mushrooms and fungi move in to take over. Life in a disrupted place comes back. And one of the things I've noted where I live in Santa Barbara is that the old Main Street is pretty derelict right now. And I've always avoided the mall. I hate malls. But for some reason, I had to go out. And I started to notice that all this life had come to the mall. They had a farmer's market. There were bands. There were people of all classes and incomes who were gathering there, but it wasn't just for shopping. The kind of life that had gone on in the main street was now taking over in the mall, which I thought was very interesting. And malls are suffering because, well, for one thing, the apparel business is in the tank, partly because everything is overproduced. I mean, you talk about people throwing clothes away after 9 wearings, manufacturers burn what they don't sell. So the malls are actually looking for more things like theaters or more things that are actually not consumer goods spaces because they can't accommodate. None of the stuff gets sold at full price. And if you don't sell it at full price, you can't pay the rent. So anyway, I just offer that as a kind of, I really noticed that when I saw it. I said, you know, this place feels alive. And I never would have suspected it.
Mm. You mentioned mushrooms. I'm going to add something here. I was reading about a company called Allbirds. This is a radical little company. Mm-hmm. And their slogan on their products is, "Your outfit is killing the planet."
Yeah.
And each of the labels has a carbon emissions score, which lets people know straight away the climate impact of their purchase. They make shoes out of trees, laces, recycled bottles. And then Stella McCartney's latest line of clothes are made from mushrooms. I don't know if you've noticed this. So the sustainability notion is taking off. Another group, Homespun Homegrown, is a little UK company that's growing its own flax and wool with the idea in a regenerative farm environment. So it's carbon fixing. Mm-hmm. And it's trying to stop us importing everything from China. And they say they want to rebuild the supply chain using local workers. Now, that's my big question next is, what happens about all the workers supposedly that are going to go out of business and be destitute if we did cut back on fashion consumption?
Well, 97% of all clothing sold in the United States is imported. The workers are in Vietnam and China. They're in Colombia. They're all over the world in places that are in the earlier stages of industrialization. So, what happened with China became the exporter of the world's clothing on the coastal cities. But once you established China, established industry, the apparel industry is very primitive and not very profitable. So that industry was chased into central China, then it was chased off to Cambodia and Bangladesh. I don't know what the overall implication is, but the situation of the apparel worker, it's very difficult to get people treated fairly. It's difficult to get a living wage paid. And I'm not sure that this is a long term. It wouldn't be better for most workers in the apparel industry to have a better job.
So do you make your products in the United States?
No, we make very little. We make, like everybody else, we make t-shirts, and very simple clothes can be made in the United States because we've lost the productive capacity and we've lost the textile capacity, partly through laws passed in the 90s, GATT and NAFTA. So we import from very high-end factories whose labor practices we vet very carefully, and we vet their environmental practices. But we're sourcing from around the world. And I really don't think, I think what will happen, the two dirtiest industries, this looking at it in one perspective, would be apparel and agriculture, textiles and agriculture, because they have not been, the oil industry is much more efficient than the apparel industry. So is the automobile industry. There, a lot of thought has been going into making things very efficient that also tends to bring about a lot of environmental improvements. When you're talking about apparel, you're still talking about people taking a lot of time to make a garment to fit the human form. And I think eventually you'll have machines doing a lot of that work. And when you have machines doing a lot of that work, it makes it more possible to bring a lot of that work back on shore. In Europe, it would be bringing back the production from Eastern Europe to Western Europe. In Asia, it would be bringing back production to Korea and Japan from the countries that are less advantaged.
Well, certainly that's the thinking behind that small company in England, is that they're going to want everything to be sourced and made locally.
And so
I think that has to move up in terms of our priorities.
The interesting thing is they're all very small scale. And I think that that's a good thing. But I think what you want to do is to develop more small scale businesses. Patagonia is kind of beyond that. We do some small scale recrafting or using used cashmere to make a new sweater. But there is a potential to create kind of artisanal clothing locally. I think a lot of it is going to be very expensive, but
it will last.
It could last, and it changes the relationship to things because
you have less of them.
You have less of them, but also you have the potential to have something that's really made for you in some way, personalized.
I just wanted to just add something basically to this issue of work overseas versus local. And that's just that I had a conversation with the CEO of one of the factories in Bangladesh that makes a lot of fast fashion clothing. And I approached him because I thought this is a person who's going to push back against the idea of reducing consumption or making more durable goods, because that, you know, his factory makes the opposite. His factory makes cheap and disposable goods in Bangladesh and employs a lot of people doing it. The person I ended up contacting surprised me. I mean, he had precisely the opposite attitude towards this that I anticipated. He himself said that he felt that bringing fast fashion to Bangladesh had been damaging to Bangladesh because it puts a downward pressure on incomes for garment workers, to the point that, you know, people often think, well, we're giving these people a job. He said that in the apparel industry in Bangladesh, people are paid a low income, not only at a global scale, but at a Bangladeshi scale. So these are poor paying jobs, even within Bangladesh. He feels that it has come with pressure on Bangladesh to reduce or eliminate environmental protections. You know, ultimately, he came down on the same side that I am, and you know that I think Vincent is, where you want to be making fewer but better quality things. He thought that would slow the pace of work for his employees, that they would feel prouder of the work that they produced, that they would feel like their work was valued by consumers over here. Yeah. I mean, I was quite surprised to hear from him that, you know, they're aware that we're buying the stuff that they make with their labor for, like, at fill a bag sales, you know, where you stuff a bag full of stuff and pay $25 for it. You know, they're aware that this is happening, and they feel like they feel a loss of dignity around it. So, you know, ultimately he said, even if it resulted in fewer factories, if the end was fewer factories with people with living wages and better quality jobs and more environmental protections and so on, that would be a fair trade-off for a country like Bangladesh.
I read the same in an article, the BBC Today, interviewing someone from an Indian factory, said the same thing, that they ultimately would be better for the workers. They wouldn't work under such pressure, they get paid more, and they produce better products. Okay, well, a quick question came in. Michelle's concerned that fossil fuel companies will ramp up plastic production as gas and oil consumption drops. Clothes are made from fossil fuels, so won't the pressure be on to increase production?
I don't know. I don't know that there's going to be a lot of pressure on apparel companies. It's polyester and nylon are two fabrics that we use. We're getting away from the use of virgin fossil fuels and going to 100% recycling as quickly as we can for those two items, for those two fabrics. But the point that Michelle makes is quite true, that there has been a lot of increase in plastic production for single-use packaging and for spreading single-use packaging around the world. It wasn't common in Asia until 10 years ago and has now produced big problems.
Greta points out they're getting into upcycling in Gloucester, Massachusetts, and they participate in what's called generous culture, settling unwanted items. Oh, setting them out for others. Can James speak to these practices?
Yeah, all of these sorts of issues like upcycling, recycling, sustainable production, all of these approaches are important and can make they potentially make a valuable contribution. My concern is that if what they do is sustain overconsumption, if we maintain the same attitude toward consumption, then I think it's very difficult. You know, I spoke to a t-shirt manufacturer in the UK who has effectively sorted out how to dissolve clothing and turn it into, you know, its base components, either nylon pellets or a cellulose material that can be respun into. So you could basically put t-shirts in this system and take t-shirts out the other side of the system. But I said, well, if we continuously need more and more and more t-shirts, does this work? Can a circular economy deliver that? And she said, well, no. I mean, at a certain point, you have to add resources to the circle, you know, if you're just going to continue to grow things. We can upcycle things, but if we continuously want more and more things, then upcycling is also going to need to add new materials to the mix in order to meet that consumer appetite. This has been the problem. This has been the frustration with green consumerism over the past 20 years, that almost everything that we use and make today is, or use and own, and everything we do today is, we can do it more sustainably than we could, or do it with more sustainable products than we could 20 years ago. And yet the end result hasn't been a reduction, like an absolute reduction in the consumption of almost any natural resource. So at some point, it's, you know, we need to face up to the fact that it's not just a question of whether the products are sustainable or unsustainable, or their production is sustainable or unsustainable. It's a question of, can we actually reduce our consumption? Because we just can't, you know, our attempts to green consumption and have not been able to keep pace with how fast our appetite for consumption has grown.
Right. You actually had a rather kind of a sad note in the book. You said you can be the change in the world, but it will not change the world. And I assume you mean by this, it's not enough on its own. Won't this encourage people to give up, though?
No, I mean, that is a pessimistic moment. But I mean, right after that, I do say, that's just me being realistic as a journalist. History has shown us that we keep coming to this place again and again, where there are these movements that say consume less, and then 10 years later, we're consuming more. And I think it's because we put the responsibility for reducing on the individual, and there's only so many of us that are going to do that, and so many of us that are going to sustain it. We need to combine that focus on personal change with a focus on changes in the system, right? And then we might actually see the potential fulfilled in our interest in reducing consumption.
So thank you so much, James McKinnon, for making the time, and Vincent Stanley.
Thank you.
Thank you. And everybody that joined us for today's discussion, the day the world stops shopping. Cambridge Forum is made possible through the generosity of Herbert and Dorothy Vetter, the Lowell Institute, Mass Cultural Council, and the City of Cambridge, as well as you. So please step up and donate via our website, cambridgeforum.org. You will find this podcast, information about future forums, and bye for now.